Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Well, welcome to the show. As usual, every week we begin with Justine's review before the interview. And Justine, I believe you probably have a book and an author to talk about today.
I do. I have Long Shadows by Kate Sherwood. It is book one in the Common Law series. Kate Sherwood's website bills her as a romance author. However, this book was a finalist for the Lambda Literary Awards for Gay Mystery and the 30th Lambda Literary Awards in 2018 for the 2017 books.
Oh, so good.
Is one of the top five mystery books of that year.
Good deal.
This is the first in a four-book series. The relationship to romance kind of develops over four books, and so at the end of this book, they're apart. It is similar to how Greg Ash handles his relationships. He's in Hazard and Somerset. He really spreads them out over six books, and then in the North and Shaw books, Borealis Investigations, he splits them over three. And this is the same kind of pacing. The romance is there, but the mystery is prime. Jericho, the first main character, comes back to Moseley, Montana. He's an LAPD detective, and he comes back to his hometown when his father is injured and he needs the help, and he gets there and discovers that his father is dead under suspicious circumstances, and his ex-boyfriend, Wade Granger, is a suspect. As soon as he gets there, the DEA agents show up, and because it's in Montana, then you know that they're running drugs across the border. I think every mystery that I have read that's in Montana always involves drugs running across the border.
That's because nobody lives there.
Nobody lives there, and people who live there just live there for the drugs across the border.
Sorry to our Montana listeners.
Well, I'm just saying, to the Montana listeners, I think you're a much more diverse state, but somehow in mysteries you get tagged with the drugs across the border. In the course of investigating, trying to figure out what the hell is going on, he discovers that his father had a second wife and he's got two half-siblings who are both preteens, and all of a sudden he's got instant family. And I think it gets a thrilling, another thrilling recommendation.
This is our second thrilling in a row.
Yeah.
Actually, is it a third?
No, I think the two books ago it was an intriguing.
Ah, you're correct. So, but we have two.
But it was thrilling before that. So I guess I'm in the mood for thrilling this month.
And nothing wrong with that.
No. And this week, Recruit Tales is coming out with three biographies or bibliographies. Murder and Mayhem by Matt Lubbers Moore, which is a bibliography of every single gay mystery book since Arthur Conan Doyle in 1909. And then we have two books by Ian Young. One is a bibliography of almost every book with a gay character in it until 1982. And since that book only had almost every book, then there's a supplement, which is new, which has all the books that he missed.
Wow. Those are three good bibliographies.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm familiar with one Matt Lubbers Moore has been doing because he's actually going to be a guest on the show again, I think, in about a month.
Yes.
He's coming on to talk about that book. I look forward to it. I think it's going to be an awesome thing. Definitely a good reference for me and probably a lot of other people.
Yeah. There's
a lot of great LGBTQ mysteries out there.
Yeah. So those books have all come out this week, and they've been a huge effort.
And that's all for you this week?
That's it.
Well, that was quick.
Sorry.
Okay.
Well, but, you know, Maria didn't interrupt me, so I guess I got through it pretty promptly because she didn't bark this week like she did last week.
Yeah, if anybody missed last week's, Maria, her dog, interrupted us quite a bit. So, but she was quiet this week. She stayed calm. So
thank goodness.
Good for her and good for you. So anyway,
we'll be back next week, and good luck with the interview.
Well, thank you. If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Today's guest is best-selling author Amy Tasakata, who writes Japanese-influenced gay fiction. Her works span from a wide range, from gritty mafia thrillers to fluffy to contemporary romance. Amy uses her deadly but delicate writing style to weave exciting tales of suspense, love, and gore. When Amy is not writing, she can be found drinking tea in a frilly dress. Welcome, Amy. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Right now, I'm picturing you sitting in your frilly dress.
Yeah, well, that's what I like to wear. It's a Japanese street fashion. I've been wearing it for about 10 years now. So, I don't know. It brings me a lot of joy.
Well, good. Good to have you on. I hope it makes you relax a little bit.
Yes.
As I said, you write romance novels, but you also write gritty thrillers associated with the mafia. It's quite a difference. What attracts you to the mafia stories?
I don't know. I especially write Yakuza, so I think it's fun. They're kind of like white knighting of themselves. I don't know if you know much about the Japanese mafia, but they always think that they're you know, protecting the people who don't have a voice. And I don't know, that's kind of interesting aspect of these kind of gangsters that try to be very silverish in a way and help those who need protecting. While they're doing horrible things too. So I find that dynamic interesting.
Well, and as you mentioned Yakuza, they're members of the Japanese crime syndicate.
Yes.
They're having a problem dealing with the encroaching Korean mafia in mm-hmm. these stories. Where did you learn about the mafia syndicates and how they operate?
Just lots of research. I really like Takeshi Miike. He's a director and he does a lot of Yakuza movies. And I would watch those just for fun when I was a teen and stuff. And then when I started playing American Mahjong with a bunch of older ladies, and when we'd play and I would wait for their turn to go, I would always think back to those like Asian gangster movies I saw where they are always playing Mahjong, and I felt very gangsterish playing Mahjong. So that's kind of how the story came about.
Now, between romance and thrillers, do you find one more difficult than the other to write?
I always found romance were difficult because, like, the mob, if they're angry, they could, like, punch someone. And, you know, it kind of gets the pace moving along a bit.
So in romance, you can't do that if they get a little bit angry.
Yeah, no punching people quite in romance.
Well, let's talk about the Yakuza Path series. Sure, your thrillers, as we said. Now Murata is the protagonist. He's a former member of the mob who, to me, seemed not all that reluctantly to throw himself back in the mix. Could you describe Now for us?
Yeah, he starts out, this is, so far it's a 5-book series, so he kind of starts out with his boyfriend that he had for a long time, who was the love of his life, kind of died in front of him dealing with the mob, so he became a tea seller, but because his father is the godfather of the mob, he's kind of not able to really pull away from that life. And then once the Koreans come to try to take over Kyoto, he's kind of thrown back in because he's a I like to say he's like a nationalistic bastard, because that's how kind of how Yakuza are. He can't have the Koreans trying to take over Kyoto.
Well, when your dad is head of the mob, it's a little hard to walk away.
Yes.
Before we forget, we need to let listeners know about your first novel in the series, which is the one that I'm reading, and that is Bloodstained Tea. You currently have a screaming deal for readers that's too good to pass up.
Yeah, right now the first book in the series is free just to get everybody to dip their toe. I know that, you know, Japanese settings and Yakuza might be a new experience for a lot of readers. So I'm trying to make it as easy as possible for people to try something new.
Now, because of the Japanese setting, do you find it harder to market to the American-centric public?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot of people who are into like Japanese anime and stuff like that. I think it's maybe harder to market because it's a very bloody, gory series. That's just what I really love to write. So I think a lot of people are kind of used to these mobsters that don't do quite horrible mobby things on the page, and my people, they do it all on the page. There's like heads and gore, and you know that's harder in that sense that people aren't used to these gay romances, or these LGBT mafia thriller series don't have quite the dark sentence that I got going, sentimentality. Yeah.
Well, if you listen to the show at all, I love a high body count. So I was anxious to get into the book. I haven't finished it yet, but I certainly am enjoying it.
Oh, that's good. Thanks.
Well, while we're talking about free stuff, let's tell our listeners about your newsletter.
Oh, yeah. So I like to say my newsletter is mob adjacent. It deals with a host club, which is kind of like where you go and you hang out with people and you pay them to pour the drinks for you. And it deals with Iroha, who works like he has someone come in and helps a nephew of a mobster sell paintings. And basically every single month, I send a free chapter to people who are on my newsletter. So that's a free, you know, chapter every month for this book. And that's kind of the only way to get it right now is to subscribe to the newsletter.
So a little monthly series. Now, it's important to note that Bloodstained Tea and your second novel in the series, which the name escapes me.
Better Than Suicide.
Better Than Suicide. Each of these received an honorable mention for thriller category in the Rainbow Awards. That must have felt like quite an honor.
Oh, it did. Yeah. I put a lot of effort, and I was kind of worried since it does deal with a topic not so much covered by a lot of authors. So I was excited to see that people were excited as I was to write them.
And your latest novel in the series is Flowers and Flesh and Blood.
Yes.
Your titles are awesome, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I have such a hard time thinking of titles. I'm like, oh, let's do this one.
They're great. What are you able to tell us about that story?
Oh, yeah. So this is kind of the finishing of the first major arc in the series. This is when Nao and the Korean mob kind of have their giant last battle. And throughout the series, there's a subplot of gay romance. So during this whole time, Aki is now a secretary and has been not so secretly pining for Nao over the course of like the year the book takes place. And Nao gets poisoned right at the first chapter. And he ends up figuring out that people are blaming Aki, that he's the one who poisoned him, when that is not the case. But he decides that, you know, everybody he's loved has died. So to protect Aki, he's going to send him away and just pretend he killed them. And that's going to be the end of that. And then Aki's like, no way. I'm going to figure out who the real killer is to get back with you. So Aki goes undercover and tries to infiltrate the Korean mafia because he is a quarter Korean. And he's trying to figure out who the real traitor is, while Nao's trying to figure out who the real traitor is as well. So it's kind of like a dual point of view between Nao and Aki as they try to get the Korean mob in this final last stand with them.
Well, that sounds thrilling. And I presume there's a good bloodbath?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my. So much.
Now, you said this is the end of the first arc. I presume that means you're implying that the story will continue?
Yeah, the story will continue. I actually plotted out the next 5 books back in August. So, like, you know, 6 months ago.
So we'll be reading about Nao for quite a while.
Yeah.
Now, I already asked you about your research into the crime syndicates. What about, how much research and study did you find it necessary to learn about Japanese culture, and specifically Kyoto, where the story takes place?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research. Like, I've been into and researching and, you know, into Japan media and culture, like, all my life. I've studied Japanese. While I'm not anywhere near fluent, I try to do my best with learning as much as I can. With Kyoto, there was a lot of, like, maps, and I love Google Maps. For the first book, The Philosopher's Path, which is just a path along a lot of shrines that Nao walks down. I think my favorite thing was to get on like Google Maps, and you could like walk down it virtually. So that was always really fun to do, to figure out where things are and the different stuff. And it helps that Nao's really into Japan and culture and keeping that old traditions alive. So he will always go to like as much festivals as he can. I try to highlight one festival in every book.
And that's one thing I did notice in the novel, how important Kyoto is to him. And I can see why he would get back involved with the mafia to protect Kyoto, basically. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, Google Maps is awesome. My first novel takes place in a part of LA that I used to hang out in all the time. And I wrote, you know, about the area. And I said, you know, I better check this out. And I got on Google Maps and looked around. And I'm like, hubby, we need to go take a drive because what I'm seeing is nothing like I remember. And yes. Lord knows I was Google Maps saved me in that one.
Oh, yeah. It's just so fun that technology lets you to do that. And I did that with like the festivals with like YouTube videos. I would watch those videos too, which were just so fun to get, you know, kind of like a hands-on view for when I couldn't travel there.
Yeah, you can learn most anything from YouTube. My husband's become addicted to the woodworking shows, and we have no woodworking equipment whatsoever. But if he ever wants to build a chair, he knows how to do it. What do you love about your characters?
Oh, I love Nao. He's like, he's really obsessed with tea, and I also very much like tea, so we can relate to each other that way. He's like a total tea snob, so he could tea out, and you know, he doesn't really know how to connect with a lot of people. So a lot of the times he's like, I'm going to talk about tea with you. And that's how I'm going to connect with you. And I love that. Like I have 37 different loose leaf teas.
Oh my.
Oh yeah. It's a lot. So I connect with him a lot with knowing that. And then Aki, who he doesn't appear really in the first book, but from two through five, he's kind of a side character and then a main character throughout the series after that. I don't know. He always tries to figure out what people like and tries to help accommodate them as much he can. So he's always just a really nice person, but, you know, in Flowers of Flesh and Blood, you kind of learn that niceness is just to kind of get that manipulation through them and get people to accept him and like him, since he does have some cultural identity issues that he's going through a lot.
Back away from the story and go back to you. With the, you said you have 37 different types of teas?
Yeah, different loose leaf teas. Yeah, I really like oolong tea. They're my favorite. I also have a lot of green teas.
And you can taste the difference between all of them distinctly?
Yeah, if you make them right, you should be able to tell the difference between them fairly well. I have a lot of interesting ones. Like I have one that is bitten by bugs. So like the tea leaf itself, when it's bitten by a bug, will secrete a chemical to try to detract bugs from biting it again. So it has a very distinct, sharp taste, for example.
Wow. I'm it's a little off track, but I'm fascinated by that because I have a very weak sense of taste. So I have a real struggle tasting the differences between tea, unless it's a very dark tea. I'm in awe. So we are going to take a moment here and we're going to do the awkward question that authors get. Now, I know you listen to the show, so you're familiar with this.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to spin the wheel. And then you're going to get a question that we frequently get that are sometimes not so easy to answer, or sometimes, if nothing else, takes us aback. Mm-hmm. So give me a moment here, and we're going to spin the wheel. Okay, let's see here. I'm trying to think of what category yours is. I'll just say it here. Amy, are your books any good?
Well, since I got an honorable mention, I do think they are. And I don't know, the reviews are always so fun to read. I always like go back when I'm either feeling discouraged or I just like need some more inspiration. I go back and read my reviews, which I know some authors don't do, but I always find them really encouraging, my reviews, because a lot of them are really positive. And I think my book connects with people on like a real visceral level. If you can, you know, if you're one of those bloody gory people, these books are very intense and they make you feel things, and they stick with you for a very long time. They're not a series that you can read and forget about. It's going to stay with you.
I like a person that feels positive about their books. And, you know, about the review thing, so many writers say they don't read reviews. I don't know if I believe them all. I have tried not to, but it's next impossible. I can't not do it. And I can understand why some don't look at Goodreads, because it can be the Wild West at times. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody may say on Amazon that this book was not my cup of tea, and then they turn around on Goodreads and say, that was the worst piece of crap I ever read. And I don't know why people feel they have that freedom on Goodreads. But what I find is helpful is, let's say somebody gives me a 4-star, and I'll look and see what other writers, or even let's say 3-star, I look and see what other writers they rated. And I'm like, oh my God, there's Joe Schmo. And I know he's an excellent writer, and I was rated better than he was. And that makes my day. So even he can have a not so great book now and then. So
yeah,
it's hard to stay away from them. Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about your books. So let's talk about you.
Okay.
Other than tea, most writers have something else about that they're passionate about. What about you?
I really like Japanese street fashion. Like I mentioned, I've been wearing, I don't wear pants. Like I haven't worn pants in like over a decade. Wow. Yeah. So I wear these like super frilly, like poofy dresses. Think of like Victorian dresses, kind of inspired by that. So I always like to wear that like basically every day. And they're really fancy, and I love just like the material and kind of the whole aesthetic, you know, getting dressed up just to go to the grocery store. And I always find that really appealing.
Yeah, people don't get dressed up for things anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch the old movies and get dressed up just to go to the supermarket or on a train. And now we just throw on jeans and t-shirts. So good for you to keeping that going. Here's a question out of the blue for you. On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and why?
How weird? I don't know. I guess it depends on who you ask. Exactly. I know I'm kind of quirky. Like, I know I dress really funny to some people. And, you know, I think all writers are a little bit weird, too. Mm-hmm. I guess if I had to number, I would say 8.
I think you're right about most writers. Mm-hmm. We all tend to be a little quirky. I think you have to be to be so isolated and yet creating these great stories that for other people to read. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you find writing a book series more challenging than writing a standalone novel?
No, I love writing a series because you can really go in depth with your characters and you already kind of know them. So it's much more easier to get to know them. Like with my newsletter series you mentioned, that took me, to write the rough draft took me forever to do, just because these were all like new people and I wasn't used to them. But for like Flowers of Flesh and Blood, the book that's coming out in May, it took me 2 weeks to write that rough draft. And so because I knew them so well already, the characters just kind of flowed out super easy for me.
Do you find any difficulty in keeping your characters' personalities the same, even if, let's say, there's growth? I know now it's been through some changes. Do you find it difficult when they go through those and yet still keep the same personality?
Yeah, I think you just have to go with, like, mild stages. Like, at the beginning now is very recluse, and he gets a little bit better each book, but, you know, the steps are very gradual. And then sometimes they go back, you know, not everybody stays in a perfect arc. They kind of are a little jagged here and there. So I try to keep them up. And because I plot so far in advance, it's really easy to be like, this is how he changes from this book to this book. And it's just a kind of subtle changes here and there.
Well, I usually don't ask the plotter question, but you mentioned since they plot out, how much plotting do you do before the novels?
Oh, I do quite a lot. Just because I like to know all I can about a character, because I think that those extra layers you've built in really help really make these complex characters that have different facets that you can write multiple book series out of and still find them fascinating and see how they grow easily once you know a lot about them.
Yeah, I think I told last week's guest and brought up that, especially when it comes to mysteries or thriller suspense, it's hard for me to imagine not doing an outline. And I know quite a few people don't, and my hat's off to them, but it seems like that would be very difficult.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like to know what's going on.
Do you find that after your outline, sometimes things take a turn away from the direction you expected?
Usually it's the same. I think for the one of the books, the Better Than Suicide, which is the second book, I made up a new subplot. Kota, who's like this prostitute Nao hangs out with, ends up stealing Nao's shoes because he thinks they're really cool. And for a little bit, like Nao's trying to get his shoes back, but because Kota likes them so much, he's refusing to give them back. So that was like a new additional subplot that popped up, but it was a very minor one and more just like a funny thing that was happening between them.
Yeah, I love escapade to get your shoes back in the middle of a mafia book. That's great. Mm-hmm. So when did you think back in the early years? When did you think, gee, one day I want to be a writer? When did you get that spark?
Oh, I remember in the third grade, we were finally told, like, write a short story about when you had a time machine. And I remember my short story that I wrote was 8 pages front and back, while all the other kids were like a page. So yeah, after that point, I'm like, I want to do this. So I went from being like, I'm going to be a zoologist and a writer. And so one of those things happened. So I'm really happy about that.
Are there any authors that had been an influence over the years?
Yeah, I really like Marcel Proust. He is a French author. He wrote In Search of Lost Time, which is like a massive tome. But I really loved his very elegant and detailed writing style. So he was a very big influence for me.
And what about crime fiction before you became involved writing about the mafia? Were there any major influences in that area?
I watch a lot of movies. So that would be like Takashi Miike. He does a lot of, I don't know if you ever seen any of his movies, but they kind of go like they're crime, but then they take it an extra mile and go super over the top. I don't know if you've ever seen those gory Japanese movie where they like cut off a limb and then there's like tons of blood, like much more unrealistic tons of blood. So I kind of take that for my style when I write my crime stories.
How fun. What a great influence.
Yes.
Who are you reading now?
Right now I'm reading The Rape of Nanking, which is a nonfiction story about the Japanese occupation of or the takeover of the city of Nanjing in China. I thought it was important because for Flowers of Flesh and Blood, Aki is dealing with when he goes over to the Korean mafia. He's a quarter Korean, like I said, and his grandfather was actually part of the slave labor that Japan took over. Like they took a bunch of Koreans and they brought them to Japan to make them build railroad tracks. It was really horrible. And I wanted to get that element right in the story. These characters are very much in death, and I try very hard to make it so people, when they read, also learn something. So I really wanted to explore the dynamic of Japan during World War II and how those would affect people, their atrocities that was caused would affect people in a more modern setting, and what that meant for these people later on in the generations.
Are there any modern LGBT crime fiction writers that you enjoy reading?
I really like the K.M. Merkin. I don't know, I find her story is really fun. Boys and Guns.
Any others?
I really like Jordan L. Hawk too. I know she's not really the Griffin and Wyborn series is mm-hmm. really fun. That's more historic and setting, but I think they're really fun with the little kind of throw it in paranormal element too.
Yeah, I think it's important when as a writer not to just read within your own genre. You can learn quite a bit from other genres as well. So what changes have you seen in your writing style from when you first started writing to, did you start with romance?
They were kind of both written at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What have you seen change in your writing over the years?
Yeah, I almost want to say I think it's gotten slightly more more in tune with the characters and more emotional. And you get a really good sense of death with these characters. They're not just kind of surface walkabouts.
Most of us have many layers.
Yes.
Now, you said Aki is the love interest in starting in book two. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so he now does not have a love interest at all in book one, or?
There's a love interest, but it's not, it does not end well or happily.
Thank you.
Yes, it is not a romance series. It is a thriller series. And a lot of people want to compare it to Romeo and Juliet and say, and then they're like, but it doesn't end happily. And I'm like, well, Romeo and Juliet didn't end happily either.
Not for either of them.
Yes, yes, yes. So, you know, it is not a romance, the first book, but there is a love story that kind of propels a lot of the plot.
Well, even though you have a romance, it sounds like it's a slow burn yes. In the other novels. To me, a mystery series, if I can't be guaranteed a happily ever after, that's what I really want to get out of it, because then I know it's truly a mystery. How do you feel about that?
You know, I see how people want that, and I understand them wanting that. I think I want it, especially with the first book, just to show how, you know, these guys are in the mob, and nothing for them is going to always be roses and daisies. That's just what life in the mob is.
Well, and you set it up that way, that to expect the unexpected, and it's a good way to make the reader not feel comfortable that everything is going to be okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to, you know, Nell has to make a choice, you know, for the city or for love. He picks the one that I think he would choose as that character at that moment, what he would choose.
Getting back to Yakuza, how strong of an influence do they have in Japanese culture as far as compared to the American mafia?
Well, like the Japanese Yakuza are more forward. So like they'll put their symbol on their buildings, unlike the mafia we have in the US. So they'll put their symbols on their buildings because the Japanese constitution has like people have the right to assemble. So people know them, like during like Halloween, they'll like hand out Halloween candy to people. And yeah, yeah. It's really interesting, this like dynamic they have. And a lot of people, like when there's a natural disaster, they'll be like the first to like hand out blankets and hand out money, just because they have more of a like on the ground network than sometimes the Japanese government has. So they're more well known, but at the same time, they have really strict anti-Yakuza laws. So like, even if you apply to go to the gym, you have to like sign that you're not part of the mafia. So yeah, like I said, I go into a lot of research personally. So I try to make my stories really accurate. So I end up knowing like tons about Japanese law.
I'm just bowled over. That's such a conflict there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like, if you have tattoos, not so much if you're a Westerner with tattoos, but if you're someone who's Japanese with tattoos, they like automatically associate that with the mob. So, mm-hmm. You know, you can't have tattoos and like go into hot springs because they're like, oh, you're in the mob and we can't have you here.
As we see tattoos become more and more popular throughout the world, I wonder if that'll eventually change.
Yeah, they're starting, especially with the Olympics coming up, they're trying to make it so at least like Westerners can go into the hot spring with the tattoos and not have to go to like the separate hot spring. But I think it's going to take a while just because the tattoos and the Yakuza have such a close tie with each other. I think it's going to take many, many years. And Japan's fairly conservative nation for them to, you know, get comfortable mainstream with it.
Yeah, it's so ingrained in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And how do they compare to the Korean mafia that's also in your novels?
Oh, the Korean mafia is interesting because they don't like Korea, like policemen and stuff, like the general cops in Korea are really good. So in big cities, there's not so much a Korean mafia presence, but in smaller towns there are. And the Korean mafia is actually much bigger outside of Korea than in Korea. So like I'm in Dallas, and there's actually a section of the Korean mafia here, which is interesting.
Now, as far as the way they act in other countries, is there a difference between the two? Are they very similar? Are they more fierce?
Not that I noticed. I know, like, fictionally in my books, I made them more kind of brash and more fierce, but they have that because they're in Japan, and Japan did not so nice things to the Koreans in World War II. I kind of have them going against Japan and kind of some of the citizens not quite as, you know, like getting back for what happened.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I think it's really important, like when you're, especially since I'm dealing with this foreign culture, I think it's important to really try to ingrain yourself and get all the perspectives. It's not just like, oh, I'm taking this book and it's just going to be placed in Japan. But it's really important to really sink into the characters and figure out, you know, what's going on in their heads. And that is, you know, a cultural history you also have to learn as well.
Well, Amy, I've got to say, it has been a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, it's been nice talking to you.
And I'm glad you got 5 books ahead of you so that we can have you on again.
Oh, thanks.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.